Shabbat. It's a real pleasure and privilege for me to finally meet Rabbi Nataf. I've been a fan from a distance for many years now. We had a few correspondences by email several years back when I was working at Yale and we tried to bring you there. It didn't quite work out, but we were able to make it happen now. Rabbi Nataf is not scared to say bold things he thinks the Torah says. And I think that's a really powerful role model for me in making the Torah relevant to modernity. He's an educator, thinker, author based out of Yerushalayim. And it's really an honor to have you here and in conversation with Rabbi Clapper, who really needs no introduction here, but certainly as as my high school Rebbe and someone who inspired me to think critically, I have a lot of hakarat hatov for Rabbi Clapper, and I'm looking forward to listening in on the conversation.
Okay, and as you can tell, it's a small and wonderful audience, so you're welcome to interject if you have things that you want us to say. I confess that I'm looking forward to this conversation, but I have absolutely no idea either what I'm going to say or what Rabbi is going to say. So I'm as much suspense as all of you. I look forward very much.
Okay. This is a discussion among friends. We're sort of inviting people to listen to what we're thinking. And I also, you know, sometimes when you're on a more formal panel, so they let you know the questions beforehand. And that takes
especially
some
presidential
of,
debate.
That's right. Right, well, that has to do with the IQ level over there. In any case, this is a topic that has become in the news, in the Jewish news, over the last few years, a topic that comes back from time to time. I remember being involved with it a few years back when there's some discussion at YU and reaction about the one of the Rosh Yeshiva over there said that we should stay away from anything that is not that is a violation of the Rambam's 13 principles of faith. And there was a reaction from a couple of scholars from what's his name? Shapiro.
Mark Shapiro.
Mark Shapiro and Menachem Kellner. Writing books, both addressing that, sort of taking him apart, essentially taking him to task. The questions that came up back then, and I guess there's a different variation that came up more recently, basically since 2013, vis-a-vis YCT, Yeshiva Kove Torah's, a response or sometimes lack of response to one of their musmachim, who created an organization and a website that advocates critical study of Bible and essentially adopting this rabbi adopted the what's commonly known as biblical criticism, and there was a whole to do. So I just want to cover a few basic points as to what I see the issues are, where I think some of the red lines are, and why they are, and within that context. And then I'm just going to talk with my friend Rabbi Clapper, and I'm sure we, including myself, will be coming out with greater insights than we came in. So the questions that I saw raised, I mean, it's interesting because Menachem Kellner, who I think I tried to give smicha to by assuming that he was a rabbi, and he informed me that he wasn't, so I had to take it off the page. But it's okay, because people have returned the favor and called me a doctor, which I'm not. So it, you know, when you, I don't know, I don't want to say when you're smart, but when you say certain things, people assume certain things about you. So in any case, not Rabbi Kellner, who's an illustrious professor at Haifa University, a philosopher. His claim to fame is really working in Maimonidean thought, but he dabbles in other areas of Jewish philosophy. So he wrote a popular book called Must a Jew Believe Anything? And as I said, this is sort of a response to things that were going on at Yeshiva University. which was a really clever, you know, sometimes it's all in the title and you wish you could come up with one of these catchy titles. That was a great title. And obviously it sold a lot of books. And, you know, more power to him. It's you know, as someone who writes, you know, a good title is worth a lot. So that became, it's one good way of phrasing the question, must a Jew believe anything? I think if you were looking for less headlines, a more appropriate title would have been, should a Jew believe anything? And the conclusions, I think, are much more sober. We'll get to Menachem Kellner in a minute, and that issue. An offshoot, and I think the issue that came to YCT is not necessarily should a Jew believe anything, or must a Jew believe in anything, but must a rabbi believe anything? You know, it's one thing for a regular Jew to believe something or not believe something. Is it okay for rabbis to deviate from what is standardly understood to be the Orthodox creed? And then if we answer in the affirmative in any of these questions that, let's say, at least a rabbi should believe, let's take the most minimal question, should a rabbi believe something? So the question is, what does he need to believe? And then, you know, we're speaking a Jew or rabbi, but perhaps really what we're speaking about is, should an Orthodox Jew believe anything? And should an Orthodox rabbi believe anything? Which I essentially think is really what we're talking about. I mean, we, within Orthodoxy, assume that we are the most authentic understanding of Judaism. But nonetheless, I think that the qualifier is in appropriate. And then finally...
That's a question you can raise itself. Maybe,
sure.
Should an Orthodox Jew believe that Orthodox, or must an Orthodox
right.
Jew believe that Orthodoxy is the most
authoritative, right.
authentic
right.
Judaism?
Sure, that can be
that
raised
itself
as well.
Is a question.
Right. The last question, which I think is the easiest question to answer, is, are those beliefs equivalent to, you know, let's assume that even Jews should believe certain things, according to Judaism, according to our tradition, is that equivalent to the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam? So I think it's the easiest. I think ultimately what Menachem Kellner ended up proving in his book, along with Mark Shapiro, who made it really the the center of his book, is that there has been a lot of discussion back and forth, and as opposed to issues of practical halakha, there haven't been clear-cut decisions as to what a Jew must believe. That being the case, clearly, I don't know clearly, but certainly I think a strong case was made by both of these authors that the Rambam's approach and specific 13 principles is not a bottom line that people can't disagree with, in the same way that, let's say, a position about Shabbat that's agreed to in the Shulchan Aruch and later poskim, there's no wiggle room to such a thing that's been established, as opposed to the Yud Gimel Midot, the Yud Gimel Ikarim, the 13 principles of faith, where there is, in fact, some wiggle room. That being said, I think that they failed to prove or to show that there's no such thing that a Jew must believe in. All that they showed ultimately was that it's not equivalent to what the Rambam says. In fact, there's some quotes in Kellner's book itself, which essentially show that the title is more of a slogan and more catchy than anything else. He says things like, let's see, Judaism teaches truth, and Orthodoxy understands that truth more completely than competing versions of Judaism. Those versions are wrong and mistaken. He continues later in the book, and he says there are limits, and this is really, I think, asserting that, in fact, the Jew must believe certain things. He gets out of it, I mean, he wants to show in his book that a Jew does not have to believe anything. But if you read carefully, that's not, it's essentially not what he says. What he does say is as follows: there are limits to what one can affirm or deny and still remain within the Jewish community. So is that must, is that should? Even for Kellner, there really are limits. And I think it's very hard to get out of that unless you want to take away any definitions but that of action, I think it's very difficult to get out of the notion that the Jewish tradition does create ideological limits. I guess one of the truth is the Talmud discusses ideological limits in different contexts in various places. The most famous is Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which everybody knows, but a very famous Mishnah, which was the subject of a lot of discussion to try to understand it and often to try to limit its scope. But the famous first Mishnah in Perek Chelek in Sanhedrin, where it says that all Jews have a share in the world to come, however, these do not. Who is it that does not? So it specifically lists three ideological categories, specifically someone who denies HaOmer, right? Some people make a big deal out of the, hey, you have to actually say it. But in any case, if you deny Tchiyat HaMeitim is coming from the Torah, the revival of the dead, if you deny the Torah Min HaShamayim, that the Torah is from God. And then a third category, which is more broad, which the Mishnah itself doesn't explain, called the Apikores, which is interesting that that's a third category. In any case, I'm going to try to not be too lengthy, even though there's plenty more on this to say. But in any case, this is something that, again, is in the sources, seems central to the sources. As I said, it's something that ultimately I don't think that any Orthodox scholar working within the normative tradition can deny, even though people who are way out there, like Avi Sagi in Israel, would like to deny it. I think it's very difficult to do so. Just in terms of the context of the more recent discussion with YCT, with Chovevei, who both Rabbi Clapper and I have worked with in the past, certainly in the Yemeyun, the Tanakh Yemeyun. I remember someone telling me that that's a separate thing, that it's okay to do that, that you're not considered part of their camp by doing that. But I don't think that was a concern for either of us. So we're on some level, you know, we're friendly with the institution, and certainly friendly with people there. But the incident that happened in 2013 with this Musmach, who went far outside specifically on the issue of Torah Min HaShamayim, was a challenge for the people at YCT. And they had a hard time sort of saying that he stepped outside of the bounds of orthodoxy. And over the last 3 years, that's been a continuing discussion that both Rabbi Clapper and I have been tangentially involved in. And I had advised people at YCT in the last year to speak more boldly about the limits of orthodoxy on this issue for their sake. Because ultimately, I think that many people have or were considering writing them off from orthodoxy. This has some interesting developments. I don't know how many people in the room have been following that particular discussion. But with a few months ago, so a group of YCT Musmachim put out a position statement about that, and they coupled it with something else which was sort of funny. They spoke about Torah Min HaShamayim and Partnership Minyan, that they denied both, and I advised.
They affirmed the first denial.
Right. And I advised people YCT that it's not one issue. You can in fact continue to be okay with partnership minyanim and still understand that Torah Min Shamayim is in fact a red line. And that's exactly what they did in response. Now, I don't want to poo-poo the you know, it sounds funny, the notion of partnership minyanim being a red line, which I think it's not. But I think that the intention was a little more profound than that. But I don't want to go in that direction.
So Excuse me, what is partnership?
Partnership minyanim are basically a type of egalitarian minyanim within halachic confines, trying to, for example, one of the things they do is to wait till not only till there are 10 men in the room to start, but also 10 women. Uh-huh. And they try to involve women as much as possible. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what it is on one foot. But again, I don't want to talk about partnership minyanim unless people are particularly interested in that. My issue was more on issues of ideological, I don't know if we want to call it doctrine or dogma, whatever it is, simply to assert that, yes, it exists in Judaism. And then the question becomes, well, what if you find yourself outside of those bounds? And I think it does make a difference whether one's a rabbi or one's a layman. There's much more at stake if one's a rabbi. But to the person that can't, that sees no other way to understand the origins of the Torah than what is accepted in the academic community, that it's essentially various documents that came about at different times, and that there's really no literal sense of any divinity, any divine authorship in it, then the question is, what can, what should one do with such beliefs? And I'm just going to make a couple observations, and then I'm going to start talking or asking for discussion. Number one is, a lot of people come up with deep philosophical questions, and with our students, you have an illustrious student from your high school teaching career in the audience, maybe more. So we know that they come up, even high school, even before, with some really important, deep questions. The question that, first of all, I'm not sure how qualified most teachers, or even I am, to answer these questions, but the notion that that a student at any level, with most backgrounds, can really make a decision as to what is actually correct. And these are issues that great philosophers have broken their minds over. So on some level, we're playing a game. And to get serious with a person who says, well, you know, I've come to a conclusion, there is no God, or whatever. So my response is, who are you, Immanuel Kant? You know, like, are you really on a level that you can investigate all of the evidence and process it and come up with definitive conclusions? I think that part of the issues of belief is a question of modesty. I mean, on some level, that presents a certain agnosticism, but I think there's a reality to a certain degree of agnosticism that exists within our reality as modern Jews. That being said, to have a clear-cut belief against Torah Min HaShamayim or against the existence of a personal God, I think one really has to know quite a great deal in order to definitively come up with such conclusions. Rather, I think that belief for most people is really a default to what does the community believe. I think Rabbi Lichtenstein, my mentor, essentially had similar comments that he wrote about biblical criticism. He wrote them actually in 1962, I believe, but they were only published in 2010 with his approval.
Where?
Sorry?
Where was it published?
It was in a book that came out of the Gush, some Shalom Bonaich, I think. I don't recall the name of it. I think it's called Shalom Bonaich, maybe. The Gush where he was the Rosh Hashiva.
Who are you quoting? I didn't hear.
Rabbi Lichtenstein, Aaron Lichtenstein.
Okay, got it.
Of blessed memory. So he said that he compared it to the problems that certain Victorian English people were having with the equivalent of Bible criticism at their time. And the observation that he made, that it came, the people that were challenged and that succumbed to this new beliefs were people that had weak connections culturally and religiously to their beliefs. So I think there's a lot of it to that, that ultimately people are questioning for all sorts of reasons, not necessarily for intellectual reasons, though they may think they are, which is always tricky to deal with as a teacher, because one needs to take people at face value what they think they're actually asking. And I think Mordechai Breuer is an interesting example of that. Mordechai Breuer, famous scholar in Israel, a religious scholar who was convinced by the teachings of Bible criticism, but it didn't prevent him from also believing in Torah Min HaShamayim, which for most people it's a contradiction. You can't believe in both. So ultimately, in terms of his faith commitments, he subscribed that God is in fact responsible for everywhere, but I assume something to that extent, traditional conception of the Torah being given by God to Moshe, in a way that's coming, that there are contradictory and different approaches. He calls it bechinot, as opposed to documentaries. Documents, rather. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Is he related to Joseph Breuer? And if so,
related,
they're different offshoots of two generations back.
The Yucky Breuers.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a traditional type of Yucky that you would think of, at least intellectually.
He's the grandson of Isaac Breuer.
Yeah.
Joseph Breuer's brother.
Okay. There you go. Okay.
Or uncle. No, maybe brother. I'm not sure.
I didn't do well in Yavamot, so I'll let you handle it.
Didn't make it an essential part of the high school curriculum,
right,
even though
right.
It was prayers.
One final question. We're speaking more about rabbis than laymen. So let's say a person says, it's I simply don't believe that God gave the Torah to Moshe, but I like orthodoxy. What does that person do? So I think there's room, and there always has been room, for what in other quarters is called fellow travelers. And in the Communist Party, there were true communists, the people who held from the doctrine, and that other people who felt that they were doing good things and it was worthwhile working with them. So I don't think, the Orthodox rabbinate or the Orthodox community by and large, I think Chabad takes that to an extreme. But the idea that we're welcoming to anybody who wants to work with us, doors are open, and that ultimately such a person is best served for many reasons, remaining within the community, even if it's ultimately a community that they don't have full ideological membership in. Okay, and then I'll leave it at that. There's much more I could say, but like I said, I'd rather have a conversation with my colleague and with all of you, so I'll let you,
thank you,
rebut or...
So I think I don't want to start by rebutting. I want to start by thinking of different kinds of abstract framings, and then we can decide whether we want to be really abstract or really concrete. So I think there's a lot of philosophic grounding that we need to do, and we need to figure out how we want to make that play out in conversation. So just one question is to ask whether what you believe is a choice. Mm-hmm. But I think that the way in which we relate to, right, if you think belief is just something you have and not something you choose to have, so then it's very hard to use the word should. Like I think that all male Jews should be 6 feet tall and be able to dunk. Right, and you're less of a Jew if you can't do that, but nonetheless, right? That's right. So I think that's one big question is the extent to which we see belief as a choice. A second question is, what does it mean to believe something? Is belief So a story that I always like to say, I had a number of students, particularly students who were trained by rationalist teachers. And so one of my favorite moments would be students who would come to me and say that I really love Orthodoxy, and one of the things I love about Orthodoxy is davening, but I don't believe in God. And so I want to know whether I'm allowed to daven or whether davening is a bracha levatala.
I love this.
Right? That's, you know, there are fancier ways of beliefs, right? You know, there are lots of people who enjoy, who like to self-conceive as heretics, who like to ask the question, if you take the position that you're not allowed to drink wine that was touched by heretics, are they allowed to drink wine that they pour for themselves? Right, so the question is, do such people really, is their description of themselves accurate when they say they don't believe? Is a statement, right, because they start off with a definition of belief is, I only believe things that can be proven to me. And they can't prove this, so they think they don't believe it. But I don't know, I tend to think, with students, I tended to tell them that although I think it's very good practice in campus rabbis, certainly, probably rabbis generally, to take people at their self-description. But in this particular case, I would say, no, you're wrong, you actually believe, go down. it's a very complicated notion, and particularly as somebody who is not...
Didn't the Rambam already answer this question in his Mamar al Kiddush Hashem, where he points out how Chazal over and over pointed out that the biggest Rasha, who certainly didn't believe, but if they did anything which seemed like a mitzvah, they would get credit for it. And he pointed out an argument against the Chacham, who wanted to say so that because you converted...
What the Mamar al Kiddush Hashem is a whole complicated... We'll talk about the Rambam in other contexts than the... we'll talk about the Rambam specifically.
No, but I mean, as regards the basic idea that just because you don't believe, is that considered like an avera on the part of somebody else? Let's take your specific example. Somebody who doesn't believe and wants to daven and so on, and to somebody else who does believe, to yourself, is he considered as if he made a bracha levatala? And the Rambam is saying, no, if he wants to do
I don't want to get into the Rambam's position. Let's
And he's pointing out that that's what the Pesha of Chazal.
That's also a very historically contextual document.
Yeah, that's right. Mamar al Kiddush Hashem. I had this question, also where Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he thinks that there are certain people you can't answer amen to their brachos.
You can't what?
You can't answer amen to their brachos. Uh-huh. And so I asked this question to various people. Rabbi Marvin Simkovich, who was one of my colleagues at Maimonides, asked this question to Rabbi Tversky of blessed memory. Rabbi Tversky's response was, if he were eating an apple, would you tell him not to make a bracha because it's a bracha levatala? No, we tell the Jews to make bracha, right? At the moment, if they wish to make a bracha, then they're believing. So I think that the question of what it means to believe, right? Lamb has an important article on the difference between cognitive faith and affective faith. Right, cognitive faith is what you believe rationally, affective faith is what motivates you to act. And he was fairly open to the notion that lots of people would not be able to make the statement, I believe absolutely, but they behave as if they do. And maybe that really, the measure of belief is action, as opposed to, because I think particularly, and there we have to talk about the Rambam, so the Rambam lived in a world in which logic was capable of producing truth. If you thought properly about something, you would reach the right conclusion. He was not bothered by the notion that you had to pick your premises. Because he thought that if you live properly, you would arrive at the proper premises in some way. I think that for post-Kantians, where once the sort of the dangerous idea has really become broadly accepted, maybe that's the kind of assumption the Rambam thinks that if we were healthy, we wouldn't have, that logic is a property of the human mind and not a property of the world. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the most that logic could do is tell you this is the kind of thing that human beings are set up to believe. It can't tell you that it's true. It just tells you that if you're a human being, right, that's how you think. But maybe human beings have radically limited perceptions. Once you have that, the notion of
But then you can't do new things. But we do new things based on logic.
That logic is sometimes true. Maybe logic is good at physics and not bad at metaphysics.
Right.
Right? Euclidean geometry is really good at certain things, but it's not a good description of the world.
Right, but it doesn't. We know it. It doesn't encompass all of geometry.
Now we know this. Right, but we could be engaged. Right, we could be philosophically engaged in Euclidean geometry and have successfully solved certain sorts of problems. And someday somebody's going to come up with something with non-Euclidean theology, and we'll discover. I'm saying the equivalent, right? We'll discover that everything, which is essentially.
That's why I need empiricism.
Right, essentially, we're not going to go there. Right? Well, essentially, yes, what a lot of the last 2 centuries of theology are about, right? Trying to construct essentially a non-Euclidean theology in that sense, which doesn't work on the assumption that reason is a reliable source of truth. I tend to think that people who make the statement "I believe" and think that their belief is rationally demonstrable are simply bad philosophers nowadays. Often when I have these arguments with fellow Orthodox Jews, so I have a similar, but your comment was, you're smarter than Kant, so my comment usually is Thomas Aquinas thought, Catholicism was demonstrable, a lot smarter than you. Right, so the notion that you can prove things that, Thomas Aquinas didn't logically reach these conclusions, but you did, and yours are superior, and his isn't, right, that never made much sense to me. So that's one, I think we have to be very careful about one aspect of the should, which is the assumption that beliefs are volitional, that you have a choice. A second, which is the notion that belief means the capacity to read the animamin and take that as a cognitive statement. And then I have a third thing, which relates to what you said about the Omer, which I am one of the people who makes a big deal out of the Omer, for a simple reason. So when you say that you should believe something, so there are two ways to understand that. One is you should believe it because it's true. And that's not a moral statement. That's not a valence, right? It's just generally, right, it's better to believe, whatever reason, why we think that it's better to believe true things than false things. We don't blame you.
Trump wouldn't agree with that.
Right? We don't blame you for believing for believing false things. It's not a moral, right? It's not a moral failure. Right? It's just it's better, right, that we have a bias towards truth. Now, that's not the same thing. When we tell you, let's say if I tell you that you should not make tea in a cliché on Shabbat. Right? You shouldn't make tea by putting the tea bag into the water that's been poured from the urn. You should pour that water into another cup, all right, and then you can make the tea. So now I tell you this. I tell you this is what you should do. Now, when I make that statement, I'm making that statement because I believe that that is what the halacha handed. Let's suppose, right? That is what the halacha handed down from Moses to Moses Sofer, etc. Going on. Right, that became the halacha. Now, let's suppose that I'm wrong. And in fact, the vast majority of Orthodox rabbis for the past 200 years who have made that claim are wrong. Either they're wrong because really a klisheni is good enough, right, or really they're wrong because a klishlishi is not good enough, because you know what? At the end, you put the tea bag in, it cooks. What difference does it make what cup you're in, right? There are lots of good reasons to think that we are incorrect rationally about how you have to make tea on Shabbos. Nonetheless, I think it's reasonable to say you should make tea the way Rabbi Chassis tells you to make tea, whichever way it is, because there is a virtue in obedience. And the virtue in obedience is probably more important than the specific virtue of doing Shabbat the way that you think exactly conforms to the medieval texts. I don't think that's true about truth. I don't think that there's a virtue in... And I think you should do this even if you think that Rabbi Chassis is wrong and you know how to make tea on Shabbat because Rabbi Chassis is getting the Shulchan Aruch wrong. I don't think there's a virtue in authority, and certainly if you think that the Gemara got Chumash wrong, so what? Right? Because you're bound by the system. But I don't believe... I guess there's that word again, right? I find it very uncomfortable to say that God would tell you, right, that the right thing to do is to believe a falsehood because of authority. I find that a very hard thing to say. So people, right? So I don't think you can ever tell people that there's something that they genuinely believe to be true, that they have to believe is false. I don't think you can ever tell people something they genuinely believe is false that they have to believe is true. So with all that, now we have to talk about, so what is the purpose? Rabbi Nataf is certainly correct. What is the purpose in having dogmas? So I have one other qualifier. I think that we should all be aware that at many, many points in Jewish history, if you were to take a cross-section of the Orthodox, let's see, the Orthodox authority, whatever constitutes Orthodox authority in that day, some combination of scholarly and and communal authority, and you ask them, what are the things that you must believe to be a member of this community? There would be certain things on that list that we would not put on the list today. At every point, there have been things that they thought were absolutely essential.
Like what?
That we say, you might believe the Rambam has a very precise list, which is part right of exactly the nature of God. Maybe those sorts of abstractions are not as meaningful. Maybe if you took certain sections, it would say it's not enough to believe in Drama and Shemayim. You have to believe that every single letter of the Torah is exactly the same as it was from Moses to Sinai, and there's been nothing whatever has changed, and even if you take out your Koran Tanakh and it shows you that there's one letter different between Ashkenazi and Sephardi Sefer Torah, there is one letter, right?
Which one?
Just one letter, the Aleph and Hey in Daka. Right, so we say tough, right? And if you take out a Gemara and it points out that there are places where Chazal seem to have drashot based on letters that are different than ours, just ignore that, right? So I think that, right, that's, I think the high school I went to, that would be a mandatory belief. Maybe, even though they taught happily, our Rebbe taught me in 10th grade, and it's very important for me. It's part of why these issues have not bothered me, I think, as much as other people, is that in 10th grade, my Rebbe did take out the Gemara Shabbos, 4th Perek, and have us look at the Rabbi Akiva Eger on the side. Rabbi Akiva Eger goes through all the places where it seems that the Talmud has a different text of Torah than we do. Right, so that was very useful for me to know that Rabbi Akiva Eger already faced this issue that way. And you know what? There's Rabbi Akiva Eger on the next page. It didn't go off. and do something else. He has a list of places where it seems that the Talmud has a different text of Tanakh than we do.
Tanakh or Torah?
Torah, including Torah. Including places where Midrashei Halakha seem to be based on...
I think the Rogachev already had a basic idea of two dot as regards the rest of Nach, as regards the Ketubah.
Good, Rabbi Akiva Eger is before the Rogachev. By 100 years. So Rogachev got it from there.
Talking about it as regards to lists of like people that returned and things which had to do in the Ketuvim and...
Okay, so I'm not going to... Just biblically cases where you look at the text of the Talmud, they have a different text than we do. So I think that that's a... I'm hesitant about drawing, saying that we know at any given time what are the things that you have to believe, because I think that if you took any past time, we probably would have been wrong about at least one of them. It turns out that you don't have to believe them in quite the same way. So we have to talk about what are the consequences of lack of belief. So for Maimonides, the consequences of a failure to believe something which is true is that you don't get to heaven, because heaven is a product of true beliefs. And if you tend, which I think there are very few people nowadays who take the position that the way into heaven is to maximize your true beliefs. Right? We tend to be much more act focused and think, right, or character focused, right, truth focused. I think we have a lot of trouble with the notion that somebody who had lots, who really believed really believed the right things, but failed to act on, but always acted as if they weren't true. Right, that person goes to heaven, or that, in general, the notion you go to heaven because you got a particular philosophic detail right is very hard. So, with all that, I think that I tend to push, in terms of boundaries, much more towards a functional definition of what, and then we can talk about honestly what it takes together. I tend to think that the best definition of what one should have to believe to be in good standing in Orthodox community are the things which make it possible to believe the halakha is binding because God commanded you. So I tend to think that there's one underlying norm is you have to believe that the halakha as we have it, not as true, the halakha that we have it is binding on you, so that you have to do it, even if you think it's wrong. Right? So you have to, right? If the halakha says you can't make tea this way, tough. And the halakha says you can make tea this way, and you think, what? So we can talk about how you decide what the halakha is.
So that seems like it's switching means and the ends. The end is to have a knowledge of God.
Yeah.
And the halakha is a means to that, not the other way around.
Is that so?
So you think
I'm not sure that's a premise that you make.
That's a great conversation, as you know.
In its own right.
And what does it mean to be to have knowledge?
To purify us, but to purify us means to have the proper beliefs.
So you could say it's the proper beliefs. You could say that you don't believe that the halakha is capable of having the right effect on character unless it's associated with beliefs.
But I mean, when we sanctify the Shabbat and we say the Kiddush, it's because God created the world in 6 days.
And you have to believe literally that the world was created in six days?
No, but you have to believe that God was the creator.
So you've already abstracted.
We're doing these things to tell something about.
So I'm just pointing out, you've already abstracted, because I could tell you that you cannot keep Shabbat, right? It's pointless to keep Shabbat unless you believe that God created the world in 144 hours. And that creation included special creation of all species. Right? I could take that position. I don't take that position. I don't think you do either. So you have abstracted that belief.
But the point of all this is not so I say, is not so I get to the point where I say, I know that I have to use a kli shlishi on Shabbat. That's not the point of all that.
So I think kli shlishi, but there are, and you can jump in when you want, right? I think there are intermediate positions. I think that, first of all, I think it's very hard. Actually, it's not an easy thing. I think it's very hard to believe that, right, that you are obligated to get up and say, because God created the world in 6 days, if you think that statement is meaningless and false. So I think it's practically very, very difficult to believe that, Shabbat is binding on you, if you don't also have some kind of belief in God as creator, because otherwise, right, it's a game. But I want to make one of the other. But I think that it's not. There's a difference between saying I believe in the creator enough to believe that I should not go to work on Shabbat and instead I should watch soccer games, and saying, right, or I should read, you know, or I should read improving books. And that's not enough for me. I think you have to believe that you have to follow halakha to be a member of the Orthodox community. And I think you need the beliefs that push you past, I should do something different on Shabbat, to the belief that you want to not talk about tea specifically. It has to lead you to the belief that you're not allowed to cook on Shabbat.